This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century history guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th century history guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, history guy of the 20th century. With unemployment rates at a 25-year high, we're devoting the show today to the history of looking for work in America.
We're going to take another call now. It's from right here in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it's Emily. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
What do you got on your mind today?
Well, I was wondering about some of the differences between the influx of immigrants into the U.S. workforce in the 19th century and the influx of women into the workforce in the 1970s.
Right.
Because I know that in the late 19th century, when there was a big influx of immigrants, there was a lot of resentment, there was fear from U.S.-born workers about job shortages. I wondered if that was similar or different to the way people reacted to women coming into the workforce.
Well, first of all, I think it's a terrific question, Emily. There are some similarities in that Americans always respond with a certain circumspection when there's kind of new types in the workforce. But the first thing that really comes to mind is a big difference, which is that women were always in the workforce. Poor women were always in the workforce.
Right.
And married middle-class women had been entering the workforce in pretty sizable numbers ever since they were pushed out or stepped out after World War II. Now, I think what started happening in the 1970s, along with a few more women returning to the workforce, was women actually getting some, and I want to emphasize some, positions of real authority. And that really did rankle, and that Americans did react to much the way they reacted to immigrants entering the workforce at all.
Well, I think one of the things that so discombobulated Americans who were already here when the immigrants came was that the women were often working among the immigrants.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like one of the things that made them seem alien and sort of undomesticated was that these women would be out working and they'd be taking in boarders into their tenements and doing all the sewing and all the things that seemed to be kind of breaking down the new industrial discipline was now sort of unraveling back into the household. So I think the big difference of what happened is that in the post-World War II era, it is that the conflicts were inside the households rather than between identifiable groups of people, especially different religious groups.
Now, there is one thing, even today, we know that women are not paid the same as men for doing exactly the same thing, and the gap was even worse in the 1970s, a decade you talked about. And certainly men have reacted pretty strongly to the notion of women either managing and supervising men or women being paid the same as men. And I would imagine there were similar issues with African Americans moving north during the Great Migration or during the waves of ethnic migration. But I'm looking at my buddy Ed to find out the real answer.
Even before that, the great source of anxiety immediately after emancipation in the slave South was, would the women stay in the fields?
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, if the families could, they instead chose to have women devote as much of their energies to the family as they could. Now, of course, African-American women were in the fields for generations after that, but not with the sort of complete dominion that white men had insisted upon before, in which they would have literally women into the fields till the day they had a baby, you know, and then they would have them back in the fields very quickly. So the thing is that there's never just women's work. Women's work is always factored through region, religion, race, ethnicity, all those kinds of things. So if you think about when we say women returning to the workplace in the 70s, that's kind of coded white and middle class, right?
Right. And to just complicate that further, Ed, the women, middle class, primarily white women who were joining the workforce in the 70s, there was a difference from their counterparts maybe 30 years earlier. And that's that they thought they were there to stay.
Right.
And
right, right.
When people join the workforce to stay, they tend to notice unfairnesses. They tend to notice discrimination much more readily, and they tend to demand more. We put up with our horrible conditions here at the Backstory Studio because we don't know how long we're going to be around here. But if we knew we were going to be here for the rest of our careers,
the strike breakers might be right outside the door.
We would demand a water cooler, I can tell you.
What we're going to do, Emily, is we're going to keep you on the line indefinitely. They can't stop us, and this will keep the show on the road. No, actually, we're going to have to cut this one off. Thank you so much for calling us, though.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Emily. Emily.
Cheers.
Okay, guys, another call. We got James from Nashville on the line. James, you got some question or insight?
Well, yes. Right now, President Obama is trying to come to grips with the way of ending the war in Iraq and bringing our soldiers home. Historically, what has been the result of mass return of soldiers coming home at the end of a war?
Unemployment.
Yeah, you beat me to it.
Well, there's a brief moment of euphoria followed by unemployment.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
James, you know, more important in many ways than the actual unemployment, which followed both World War I and World War II, more important than that in many ways was the expectation of unemployment, especially in World War II. It was the mobilization, the massive industrial buildup that was very much part of World War II that got the country out of a period of terrible unemployment. So people, even before the war ended, started worrying a lot about the what they thought inevitable unemployment that would follow. So as you know, James, from today's headlines, expectations affect people's willingness to invest, people's willingness to hire, et cetera, et cetera. So half the battle was fighting this fear that the Depression was going to return. What helped a lot was all these payments that soldiers got that they weren't able to spend and they had burning a hole in their pocket. Also, Americans hadn't been able to spend on anything because a lot of the industrial work was going into wartime material rather than products aimed at consumers like cars and refrigerators. So right after the war, unemployment was not a terrible problem. People were spending that money. But by 1947, unemployment was becoming a very real problem.
You know, guys, I think the real difference between the 18th century and certainly the 20th is in the 18th century, people didn't have the expectation that government was going to solve their problems during a period of depression. Instead, in the wake of the revolution, the real problem was almost the opposite, that Americans who were no longer enjoying the fruits of a wartime economy were now suffering the additional problem of dealing with taxes that were rising because of the need to service the Revolutionary War debts. So rather than looking at government for answers, people were looking at government as part of the problem. So that seems to me an almost complete reverse from, say, post-World War II expectations, the GI Bill and so forth.
Well, actually, what I was interested in, of course, I thought about the end of World War I and World War II, you know, the bonus army and all that. But one of the things that I was really curious about was following the Civil War, where you really have another time of massive industrialization, you know, we had a lot of soldiers come home at the end of the Civil War, and I was wondering what kind of effect it had on unemployment then.
You're a man of great judgment to recognize that the Civil War is where the real questions are. You're right that the 1850s had seen really the beginning of mass industrialization in the North, and which had really, really accelerated during the war itself. Some people have argued that American industrialization was greatly accelerated by the very fact of the American Civil War. And that, in a kind of a precursor to World War II, that the economy mobilized so radically for the war that it accelerated the economy. And suddenly, the brakes just screech on after the war. And sure enough, there is a lot of unemployment. The main thing that happens, I think, that makes it a little alleviated is that there is such massive movement to the West at this time. If people are unemployed, they can set out for the new territories farther west. But it's also the case that immigration had radically slowed during the Civil War, and so much of the American industrialization before the war had been built on the expectation of a completely rampant immigration throughout the 1850s, that its stopping helped alleviate that somewhat. Now, in the South, of course, you had nothing like this because the industrialization, while real, was limited to a relatively few places. What you had there was people just trying to put together enough food to live on. So what you had there was people coming back to farms that had been neglected for years, and certainly no shortage of work. There was a shortage of everything else.
Well, James, thanks for the call. You inspired us to our usual extended discourse, and we are grateful for it.
It's kind of a make-work program.
Thank you, James.
Y'all have a good day.
Bye-bye. Yeah,
thanks a lot.
Yeah, you know, Ed, I couldn't help but think about my century, the 20th century, when you talked about immigration being cut off during the Civil War and how that provided jobs for a lot of people who had been unemployed right here in the United States. Kind of reminded me of a few generations later when World War I came along.
And you are referring, of course, to what is known as the Great Migration.
During my century, Ed.
Well, earlier in the show, you pushed into my territory with that whole beginnings of unemployment thing. So I'm going to get you back now.
I knew I was going to pay for this, Ed.
Yep, you sure are.
All right. So, Ed, Great Migration, what are we talking about? Who's migrating? What's so great about it?
So let me just give you the encyclopedia entry, all right?
All right.
So the Great Migration is a period from 1915 to 1930 when over 1 million African Americans migrated from the South to the North to work in the factories that had been vacated by the cessation of immigration during World War I.
This is a great and conspicuous movement of people, in some ways more conspicuous than the influx of immigrants to American port cities, because, of course, they absorbed immigrants. There were immigrant neighborhoods. But here was a movement almost across the landscape that you could track in time.
Yeah, and people both in the North really wanted it because, you know, they would supply these jobs and we needed it for the war. On the other hand, they were really kind of worried about what would it mean to get all these black people living together in the North for the first time and to be living in cities for the first time in these massive numbers.
So
it was a dual migration. It was across the landscape, but also from countryside to city. I'm going to play for you now an excerpt from an oral history that was recorded back in the 1980s. Now, this is a man named William Brown who moved north from Jacksonville, Florida during the Great Migration. You're going to hear him describing what happened when he went to apply for a job in the office of a Philadelphia real estate agent.
He said to me he didn't have no opening like that at this particular time, but he said to me, now, we do have an opening for a janitor, and if you knew anybody that you would recommend, we would accept. And I thanked him and walked out. And I poured over that conversation, and I explained it to a person that I knew, and he said to me, he said, you know, he was just offering you a job, a mop and broom, that's all he was doing. And I found out to my consternation that the white man up north was perfectly satisfied to ride with you on the subway cars, on the elevated trains, and sit by the side of you, because when he got up to go to where he had to go, he got up with his briefcase and went to his office. But when you got up, you went to a mop and broom because there was no office for you to go up here. But in the South, when colored men rode in the back of the buses and the trains and the trolley cars in the South, when they got up, they went to their occupations, which was bricklaying, cement finishing, carpentering, mechanical engineering, but they had to ride in the back of the buses and the transportation facilities. So it was the same thing, only just painted with different colors.
I'm going home on a morning train.
The morning train.
That was William Brown, recorded by oral historian Charles Hardy in 1985. It's part of Hardy's five-part series on the Great Migration, Going North. We'll link to the entire thing on our website, backstoryradio.org. Boy, that's pretty powerful, guys. What do you think?
Yeah, I found it very moving. But I want to ask you about the nostalgia for all those supposedly better jobs in the South. I did find that a little questionable.
No, that's actually true, Brian, that if you were a free black person in the era before the end of slavery, financially, you were better off in the South than in the North because there were jobs that were set aside for black people.
But what about after slavery? That you know, what about between the end of slavery and World War I?
No, that's actually still true. Economic historians have studied this and found that the wage rates were actually higher
in the South and the North, because, as Mr. Brown suggested, there was a much broader range of jobs that were available to African-American men. Now, if you were an African-American woman, there was virtually no job at all for you in the South. But because there were large black business districts, ironically, because of segregation, there were black men who performed all those skilled trades that Mr. Brown talked about. And so people would often give up jobs where they would have had a greater economic advantage in the South, but simply could not stand anymore the daily degradation, not having the vote, not being able to testify in court, not being able to display the property that you had. All those things, people traded for a lower status job and a clean chance in the North during the Great Migration.
And that reminds me of slavery days, when the escape to freedom could be from relatively benign material conditions into great uncertainty, into a highly segregated and repressive North, but still, you'd be free.
Exactly. They could not sell your children.
Yeah, well, guys, you think that that's really one of the central tensions that we're talking about throughout this show, this American birthright of freedom means also the freedom to lose your job?
Brian, I think it's a great question. Freedom does mean risks, choices that may lead to unhappy outcomes, but it's the very fact of being able to make those choices, the very ability to move and to try for a better future for yourself and your family, knowing full well that you're facing a lot of risks. I think that that's a sense in which the thing itself, that is the sense of being a free person and making your own choices, trumps the outcomes.
You know what, Peter, what I like about that is it reminds us that unemployment is just not a matter of numbers or bureaucracies counting how many unemployed there are. I think it's the wonderful tapes that we've heard during the show remind us that unemployment is a deeply individual, deeply felt fact for each person caught in it. And that while the shape of it constantly changes because American history changes, it's also the case that even the experience of it changes. What it means from one generation to another is shifting.
Yeah, it also reminds us that with all those experiences out there, we're really just once again scratching the surface of this story. And unfortunately, we've run out of time yet again. Fortunately, we're going to keep the conversation going on our website. Tell us your stories about looking for work, or you can just sound off about today's show.
The address is backstoryradio.org. Drop in and sign up for our newsletter, and check out the video of our recent live performance on the topic of, get this, looking for work.
That's backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Bart Elmore and Lydia Wilson.
Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabby Alter composed our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham. I'm taking care of
business, woman, can't you see? Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ryan Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.